gonna be fun. We can stay up late, swapping manly stories, and in the morning, I'm making waffles.
Oh!
Hey, this is Steve Bloom, and you are listening to the Geekcast Radio Network.
You're tuned in to Steve Megatron on Altered Geek.
Hello and welcome to Geekcast Radio presents an interview that will also be syndicated on Altered Geek. I'm your host for this evening, Steve Megatron. Coming to the digital studios tonight is David Carpenter. And if you're not familiar with David, he is a veteran of theater, the founder of Tilted Windmills Theatricals, and CEO of Gameiotics. Welcome to the show, David.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, glad to have you. So, as we get started tonight, could you tell our listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. So, I've been working in live entertainment, mostly theatrical entertainment, for about 22 years now. I am based in and out of New York City. My office is in New York City, and I spent the better part of 20 years working on and off Broadway. I produced a show off Broadway called Puffs, which probably your listeners may have heard of. It's a parody of the Harry Potter universe that ran off Broadway for about 3 years and is now the second most produced play in the U.S. I also have a software company called Gameiotics, which is diving into the gamification of audience engagement, both in and outside of entertainment.
Awesome. Awesome. So did you always want to be involved with theater, or how did that kind of come about?
Yeah. I mean, I was a theater kid from, you know, fourth grade on, right?
Nice.
Like going all the way back to elementary school. I come from an entertainment family. My grandfather was a composer in Hollywood. He was a television theme song composer. He wrote some things you have heard of, but I think the most notable things is he wrote the theme song to A-Team.
Oh, wow.
And Magnum P.I. Yeah, yeah. And so, like, there was kind of never any resistance to me going into theater and entertainment just because I came from a family that was already so steeped in it. And when I was in college, instead of going to LA, I made the decision to move to New York, probably just because I was closer to New York, and just started diving into theater. I started working off Broadway and then quickly moved to work on Broadway for a company called the Dodgers, not the baseball team, but this very venerable producing office. They produced Jersey Boys at one point.
Okay.
But they're a big deal. And that's how I got my start.
Awesome. Yeah. It's funny enough. I produce audio dramas and I get to play as a voice actor, but I was always too chicken to put myself out there into the theater realm. So getting to, but I always enjoyed the ability to have the, you know, the theatrical, I don't know, it's fascinating.
I mean, yeah, I mean, like, I come across so many people in so many different fields, right, who all did theater or did something akin to theater in middle school, high school. Like, just having, you know, the more interesting people to me, obviously, are the ones who are, you know, did played around or did something with stage and always kind of had a love for it, you know, within entertainment. So it's like, and it's just something that I always did. I was an actor. And then when I was in high school and in college, and then when I was in college, I was like, oh, I don't know if I really want to be an actor. Maybe I'll be a director. And I focused on directing for about 3 years when I was college. And by the time I hit my senior year, I was like, gosh, well, I don't really like working with actors that much, but I really like putting the shows together. Cause like when you're in college and you're the director, you're also the producer.
Yeah.
So yeah. So when I left college, I went and started pursuing a career in a lot of different aspects of management. I mean, I worked in sales and marketing. I was the head of sales at DreamWorks on Shrek the Musical for about two
years.
Cool. I was on Broadway. I ran there. Yeah, it was a fun experience. It was different. I'll give it that. But it was a really fun experience. And then I worked for a producer for about 5 years, running her office, which taught me a lot. And then I started my own office, which was Tilted Windmills.
Awesome. So switching gears a little bit, I see that you like board games and video games. So what are some of your personal favorite types of games in those areas?
Which one? Where do you want me to start?
Let's start with board games, because I'm kind of a mild board gamer, strategy board gamer, but yeah.
So like, I wish you could see my living room. There's like, I'm one of those guys that we have a stack of board games sitting against
the wall. That's awesome.
I mean, all different types. Like, I love strategy games, full stop. Like, I absolutely adore strategy games. The one that we're currently playing with our group of friends up where I live is King's Dilemma. Do you know that one?
I haven't heard of that one, no.
So it's basically a branching narrative board game. Right. And it's all strategy. And like you and there's five of us who play it. We're all sitting on the council of this land. Right. But it's hard to explain, mm-hmm. but it's like a multi-generational game. And so you make these decisions that affect the land that also kind of determine which cards get pulled next. And your choices have consequences as you're playing out this game over time. Right. And it is just, and we'll talk more about Choose Your Adventure stuff later, but like, it is just endlessly fascinating about how this game was designed, right? From a story perspective, it's a great, great story game, right? And so like, we're like nearing the end. We've been playing it for months now because like a round will take hours to do. The other one that we played for years that haven't played in a while is the Game of Thrones board game is really well designed. Have you played that one?
No, I haven't.
It's like Risk meets Stratego.
Oh, okay.
Right? Yeah. And it's Game of Thrones, so it's like you must backstab your players by the end. So, and like you really have to go we've had not fist bites, but just like very intense altercations break out like during that game in our house, just because you get really so intense because you're playing. It's like a 4-hour game to play, and you're investing so much time, and you get to the end, and everyone's just like out with knives, you know, trying to win the game at the end. I have a tile game called Azul.
I've heard of that one.
Yeah, Azul. It's like math, right? Yeah. Like it's a math game. At the end of the day, you're just trying to out math everyone that's around you. And then of course, like, and I have friends over that played that. And then of course, Munchkin, Munchkin can be a tough game, man. Like that can be really mean too. So yeah, those are the board games that one of my friends introduced me to Root. We played the Initiative. If you heard that one, which is a cipher game, with some friends. So yeah, it's like that's the thing. It's like every weekend we're playing board games with friends, right? Like it's happening. And then on the video game side, like I love first person shooters. One of my favorite games of all time was Dead Space.
Okay.
I played through Dead Space like multiple times just because I love it so much. Because like it's space and it's horror and it's a shooter. It's all things that I love. And then like I played through Breath of the Wild on the Switch, and I'm currently playing Hollow Knight right now. And I'm in this weird, like, work's really intense for me. So I'm also in this kind of, it informs my video gaming a little bit. So I kind of tend to go completionist. And I'm in this just dastardly horrible thing within Hollow Knight of trying to be completionist on it. And I'm like, I just got to stop. I got to accept 90%. And like, I accept an A and move on with my life and not go for that A+.
Yeah. I've had that issue with games in the past. So like playing the Batman Arkham games, you know, just because I love the storyline, and then I just have to take the Riddler stuff and just go, you know what, I'm not going to get them all, but that's okay. Like I've got everything else, and it's kind of the same way with like Mass Effect and other games like that. So
my favorite game, and this is, I hope this isn't too cliche, but my favorite game of all time is Last of Us 1 and 2. I mean, it's the best story. It's the best story game I've ever played in my life. Like, and it's one of the games that has just stuck with me. And when 2 came out, like that's what I did last summer, right? It was like, that's it. Like, I was like, this is all I'm doing. And I literally just like every spare chance I had, I was playing that game. Cause again, it was like horror and zombies and first person shooter, like all the things that I love.
And then it's got the storyline and it draws you in, and then you're just engaged permanently.
Yeah. I mean, like, and the thing about Last of Us is that they built it they built it so well that you really cared for those characters, right? And they did a better job in 2 in making you really invest in the characters, which, you know, sometimes in video game design is like tough to do. I feel like that's one of the reasons why Horizon Dawn is so successful, is because you actually really, you do get invested in her story and this journey that she's on. And it's a big, you know, AAA game, like it's a big, big game, but they help you invest. But Last of Us is one of the best ones I've ever played.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing that I have to play when I play a game. It has to have a good storyline. Otherwise, I just kind of lose interest.
Yeah, I mean, like, what was the name of this game that came out? Because, like, everybody was playing it during the pandemic. It was the couch co-op game about the couple who were, like, about to get a divorce, but they were then magically turned into dolls, and they're, like, kind of, like, running through their house trying to save their marriage. Like, do you know which one I'm talking about?
I vaguely know the name of it, but I
Yeah. Like, my husband and I, like, we played that for, like, 2 years during the pandemic, right? Like, that's all we played. And it was actually very therapeutic being stuck in this house together. Like, all right, we're gonna do this. But then, like, we'll play Broforce. You ever played Broforce before?
No.
It's like it's a side scroller, and it's like Contra. It's like a little, like, base, a little bit of Contra, and it's just really funny and really dumb and just, like, really fun to play. So we used to like sit down and play Broforce in some evenings. Just like, all right, let's just get a pizza and do that.
Yeah, I love the side scrollers. I just looked it up as you were mentioning it, and yeah, it does look just fun and stupid at the same time. But there's something to be said for old games.
There's something to be said for old games, which I like. Did you ever play Magicka? Magicka was a top down, but it had a good spell system in it that was fun to do. I played Magicka through a couple of times. I really liked that. My husband didn't like it very much. He didn't play it with me the second time around. But, like, yeah, I mean, it's just, like, it like, depends. Like, I'm in this rut with Hollow Knight right now that I need to get out of and go do something else. Because I've been playing it on my Switch for literally months now. But, yeah, it's like I find something and I just invest in it, and that's just what I do.
Awesome. Yeah, it's very cool to hear the different types of games that everybody gets into, and just... One, it kind of helps me because I don't always know of some of them, just because I kind of go to the same basic pool of games too. So, yes.
What kind of games do you tend to play? What do you like?
I mean, I've played, like I said, like the Mass Effect stuff, and again, it's more so because the story and just the object of the game. I've played, like, Star Trek Online, just because it's more of a the game is very meh. by today's standards. However, I play it because the storyline wraps up a lot of storylines from the show, from, like, these one-off episodes that mean nothing, or that they were starting to lead somewhere and just nothing happened with it. And so then they kind of can play through the entire continuity of the last 60 years of the universe. So that's
well, actually really cool. I love that. I mean, what great fan service that is, right?
Yeah, and I love it because, like, you can start off in the 25th century, so, like, 2409, uh-huh. Or you can start out in the 23rd century during, like, Kirk's era.
Uh-huh.
Or you can start off during the Discovery era, during that whole time. And so they've got three different starting points for the Federation, and then you've got, like, Romulans, Klingons, and the Jem'Hadar. So, I mean, you can kind of go all over the place with it. And some of the missions are the same based on the faction, and then other ones, like the Federation's obviously more fleshed out, and so you get to play a lot of continuity things that are driven from other aspects. And so, like, being somebody who watches that whole universe and kind of knows the canon, it's fun to see this, like, oh, this little, you know, tidbit that they pulled from here is, you know, it actually means something.
Oh, that's really cool. What a great way to use all your content and IP and just go a level deep, like, allow your fans to go a level deeper with it, right? Mm-hmm.
And you can create your own characters, and you can modify your own ship, and, you know, different pieces and different skins, and, you know, all the different consoles to make it do you know, one hit kills, and
that's fun.
So yeah, it's very fun. So tell me a little bit about Gameiotix and the Tilted Windmills theatricals.
So, well, Tilted isn't really around anymore. That company wrapped itself up at the end of 2019. I'd split with my former business partner, and he left the industry and went on. But while I was at Tilted, I was presented with a really interesting problem. And so this is like, you know, it's starting to produce and was looking, we had this company, we're looking for content, we're looking for things to do. And I came across this show that was basically, you were handed a remote, like a 4-button radio frequency remote when you came in. And the show was like, it was about a guy who was always really unlucky in love. And this genie appears, and the genie it was going to help him find love, right? And with the help of this really stupid device called the Chorus of Heavenly Angels, which was the audience, right? And they had this polling system built into the show, right? So it was a branching narrative show that had a point system built into it. And so at various points during the course of the show, while this guy was going on a date with the dates, the audience would make decisions, right? And those decisions were then the remotes were tied to this off-the-shelf educational polling software. So like this is the most basic stuff that you could find anywhere, right? And the audience would vote, the bar graphs would show, you know, how the audience voted, and that's what they would do. And it was about things like where they should go on their date and what the guy should say at various points and all this. And the show had like, I want to say like 11 different endings. And if the audience voted very favorably for the guy all the way through the show, then he would like sleep with the girl at the end. And if very negatively, he'd throw himself off a bridge, like, and then everything in between, right? And I remember just seeing this thing and being like, this is the first time I've ever seen anyone successfully execute this idea in a live theatrical environment. And so I actually optioned the show and started working on it. And one of the first things I realized is that the methodology of like handing something to an audience member when they walked into a venue, like, wasn't practical or scalable at all. I mean, it was fine.
No.
Yeah, it just simply wasn't. And now the show itself had a lot of problems, right? I mean, just a lot of problems. And I'd given like pages and pages of notes, and the author's like, oh, my work's perfect, I won't take a note. And I'm like, oh, okay. I'm like, all right, good luck, dude, right? But as I'm puzzling through this, right, I realized that there wasn't a mechanism that was painless, right? To allow the audience to collectively make a choice or take action. And I thought, gosh, that's an interesting problem that needs to be solved. And it needed to be solved to make that show successful. Well, long story short, I got introduced to this programmer named Dave Keen, the software engineer named Dave Keen, who at one point in his career was the senior architect of the PlayStation Gaming Network, right? And he was a lover of theater, right? And he was currently working at this healthcare startup, doing stuff with like Alzheimer's and technology. It was really interesting stuff. And you know, we presented this problem to him, and Dave's like, I can design an app. And this is back in like 2015, right? When I was like, or 2015, 2016, somewhere around them. I'm like, no, you can't. It can never be an app, right? I said the problem with apps in the live theatrical environment, the live environment, is that if the show starts at 8 and it's 8:05 and it's raining and it's gross out and the patron shows up at the theater and the usher says, okay, wait, have you downloaded the app to enjoy the show? And the patron hasn't and they're already late. You've lost the consumer, right? You've introduced too many pain points to them right to start. And so I said, and so Dave and I went back and forth. And what we came up with was this idea of web-based, right? Where you were originally, back in those days, it was like you went to a simple website, you entered a code, and then that on your phone, right? So the premise was, and this is in 16, of saying, look, the audience is already showing up at the theater with the tool to be able to engage. It's sitting there in your pocket, right? So why don't we take that tool and harness it simply in order to create an engagement device? And that's where Gameiotics was originally born. It was called something else back then, but that's where it was originally born. And so that original show I talked about, I ditched, right? Because the author and I couldn't see eye to eye. And then Puffs opened, and it was a really big hit right out of the gate. And we actually went to the team with Puffs and said, hey, we have this technology that's being developed right now. Can you write a show? And I spent 2 years and $150,000 going down a lot of very blind alleys in this show that that team was working on. And the problem was is that I take a lot of the responsibility in that process is because no one would had ever really attempted this before in the way that we were doing it. And I hadn't, I didn't successfully design a development process in order to allow this idea to really happen, right? And so, you know, I was doing it under a traditional theatrical development process and it wasn't working and it didn't end up working, right? So I spent two and a half years working on that show. And then eventually, finally, it was just like, this is never going to get off the ground and put on the shelf. And the technology had advanced a little bit, right? But not tremendously. And then I split up my business partner at the end of, at the end of 19, and I took control of all the companies. And I took control of the technology company. And I remember, and the split was fairly acrimonious, right? And I remember sitting there with my lawyer and at a restaurant while we're going through everything, and she was saying, you know, you don't have to do this. She's like, you don't, you can just walk from all of this. This is, this sucks. Like, you know, I'll help you get a job at Netflix. And then I'm like, wouldn't that be fun? But I like, and this is like the gamer in me of being like, yeah, but I still haven't actually solved this problem. Like I haven't completed this quest yet. Right. Like it's not, I'm not quite done with this yet. I just want to give this one more shot. And so I started, I commissioned a new show in the start of 2019 and I was starting to get moving forward again, you know, and then the pandemic hit and everything just went up in smoke, right?
Oh yeah.
And so I stared at the wall for a day being like, well, now what do we do? And then I realized like, all right, live entertainment shut down for the foreseeable future. I have this piece of technology. I called a group of friends together and said, we're just going to start writing shows that we can perform on Zoom. And we're going to use this technology to engage with the audience who's going to be scattered all over the place because they're not going to be able to gather together in a room, right, to watch entertainment. They're all going to be at home and we can do live entertainment if we do it over Zoom. Right. Mm-hmm. That's where this production company that I don't have anymore, but we built this company called Seize the Show, right? And in 18 months, we produced 20-hour-long Zoom shows of increasing sophistication as we went along and budget, right? And that's really where Gameiotics was born, is because what happened was is I built this lab that was a use case for everything that Gameiotics could possibly do, right? And so we did branching narratives, we did quiz shows, we did game shows, we did murder mysteries, which were super, super fun to do. We did an online escape room. We did a horror show, we did a Christmas show, we did a Halloween show, like we did all these things, right? And every time I gathered a group of writers together because everybody was out of work and I had a little bit of money from investors and I said, all right, I can give everybody a little bit of money and let's just kind of keep going. And so we just spent this a year and a half period just working at a feverish pitch. Like we'd release a new show every month, cast of all of our friends, you know, and the writing room was all friends of mine who all just kind of showed up one day. I was like, yeah, sure, let's do this. And it was amazing. And because we'd get into these writers meetings and they'd say, well, can the technology do this, right? Can we do this thing with it? And I said, I don't know. And I'd call the engineer. And then Dave Keenan had long since departed the company at that point. I'd hired another engineer. I said, hey, can we do this? And they're like, yeah, sure. Give us a couple of weeks, right? And then, and so like, we just start getting all of these new tools. And there became this moment where we were able to, because effectively Gameiotics is a two-way communication device between audience and content using their web browser on their phone, right? But it doesn't work like anything else that's out there, right? Because no one's actually purpose-built engagement technology for the live entertainment space, because for the last 20 years, everyone's saying, don't bring the cell phone into the theater. Don't bring the cell phone in the bed. Put it away. Put it in a yonder bag. They're evil. They're evil. And I'm like, what if you do the opposite? Like, because that's the thing. Like I say this a lot when I'm doing interviews and I say this when I'm talking to people is like my point of view on the cell phone is like, it's the tricorder, right?
Totally.
That does, like, I can control the temperature in my house right now, right? Like without touching the thermostat, like it unlocks the world around us. Let's take this live entertainment space and let's invite it in and use it as a tool, right? And so that's kind of the point. And then the other part of it is let's build stories and experiences where the audience has agency, right? Because for me, like choice, like especially God in this country in this day and age, having choice is so important. And I love the idea of introducing agency into the entertainment realm where the experience is crafted based on the choices in real time that the audience is making as it's going along, right? I mean, it's everything I love about video games, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I mean, that's kind of like a slightly out of order, but that's kind of where Gamiatis got born and what we're starting to do with it. But what I'm doing with Gamiatics is that I want to be able to deliver audience-directed experiences into any space where you have a live audience. So like one of the things that we're working on right now, we're developing a pilot program in-house. So I'm actually just developing this, the basis of this idea is the ability to like go to a museum and go on an adventure with you and your phone. That is based on the choices that you're making. So like taking that branch narrative experience, right? Or what you would call like a choose your own adventure style experience, not a TYOC, but a style that in that style, right? And saying, hey, if you make these choices, you're going to have this experience, but come back again. If you make a different set of choices, you have a different experience, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're developing that right now. It can do a lot of things. The phone can do a lot of things, right? And so we're building our software to do that. The other thing that we're building with it right now is 20 Side Tavern. Did you come across that in?
Yes.
Yeah. So we can talk. Yeah. I don't know if you have more questions. We can talk about 20 Side Tavern because I can talk endlessly about 20 Side Tavern because it's one of the coolest things I've ever done in my life. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, definitely. I was kind of reading a little bit about it earlier, and I was wondering how else it comes into play, because it sounds very interesting as far as the the live theater and the interactive capabilities with it, and just kind of seeing what directions you can go with it.
So during the Seize the Show days, we built a show. Sarah Reynolds, who works for me, and David Laws, who goes by Daggle. Daggle is a DM, and he happens to be Neil Patrick Harris's kid's DM, right? I'm not kidding. I'm not
making this
up, right? And so he's a really, really talented DM and an actor. He's performed at Drunk Shakespeare. He went to CMU, and he's a really super, super talented guy. And prior to the pandemic, he was trying to figure out, how do I do a D&D style game for the live stage? Like, how do I make this happen? So it got pitched in a meeting, and Sarah is a huge D&D person as well. And I said, well, let's do it. Like, what does it look like? And I said, the only, because it was during Seize the Show, I was like, the only thing is like, you have to give the audience choice and agency. So figure out what choices the audience get to make. And we did it. And it was ridiculously popular, right? And we saw an audience to come to that thing that we hadn't seen at our other shows. I'm like, okay. So when I shut down Seize the Show, I said to them, I was like, what if we just keep working on this and see if this is something we can do for the live stage? And so we got this opportunity to do it at the Philly Fringe Festival for two nights back in September. It was like in between COVID surges. And we just kind of did it, right? It was just like, two folding tables, a box of props, five people on stage. You had the software and people came in. And the audience just went nuts for it, right? And I hadn't seen that kind of enthusiasm since I produced Puffs, to be honest with you. And I remember walking out of the theater being like, oh my God, like there is a fandom and a hunger for this type of experience that I think we all suspected existed, but we just have now proven. And it's really straightforward is that we've created this big branching narrative world, right? And there is a campaign that happens. And basically what happens in the experience is that audience comes in and they're handed a red, green, or blue six-sided die, right? They don't know what it's for, right? And the very first choice, the QR code, QR code in now to access Gaming. So QR code in, and we've established communication. And the show starts. And the first choice that they said is like, what color die were you handed, right? And the audience is, presses on their phone whether they're red, green, or blue. And that sets up a system inside of Gamiatics called the cohort system. And what the cohort system allows us to do is send choices and actions on a group, on an individual group level, right? So we can send things only to the red, send things only to the blue, send things only to the green, and all three, or red and green. Like there's a lot of things that we can do with the cohort system, right? And what it is, it's the fighter, mage, and rogue, right? And so the three actors come out. One's a fighter, one's a mage, one's a rogue. And the fighter, and they all get up and they introduce themselves and they say, look, you have a choice tonight about which character I'm going to play this evening, right? And each cohort gets to make a decision about which character that actor is going to play because they don't know when the show starts, right? So you already, we start by having a new combination put on stage with these three actors and the characters. Sometimes it's the same, sometimes it's new, right? Just kind of depends how the choices go. And then from that point forward, you're just rolling into this story that the audience is making decisions, the actors are improvising, the game master is telling us where we're going. And it's like this big interactive D&D style game where everybody is participating in the creation of the story. And the environment is projected and the story can go in a lot of different directions. And the battle sequences of the dice are involved, so everyone's rolling dice. And it's just like, it's a comedy, right? So it's a really funny thing. And so we put this thing together. We just did it in Pittsburgh in April. And like, I've just never seen anything like it before, right? And like, and it's like between the, for the three of us, because Sarah Daggle and my partner's on this, between the three of us, like we're all like finding something about what we love about gaming, about what we love about video games, what we love about board games, what we love about theater and interactivity. And it's all being kind of combined in this experience that we're creating. Because it's not theater, but it's a show, right? If that makes sense, right? And it's a game, and it's, and everybody has stakes, and it changes every single night. So we have people coming back over and over again to play different aspects of the game. And so we're going to Edinburgh Fringe Festival with it this August. We're going to be doing a week in New York at the DR2 Theater, Darrell Theater in Union Square, to prep ourselves for Edinburgh. And then other things are coming after that that are currently in the works. But you know, what we've discovered very early on is that the audience that is coming out for this is it looks like our shows look like the floor of a Comic-Con. Like you have everybody dressed
up in
different
cool
costumes from different things, like from Star Trek to Lord of the Rings to Norse mythology, you know, to like, to people just wearing capes, right? I had this one family that showed up like at the theater and they were just sitting there playing Magic the Gathering. And I'm like, you guys like, and they're like, no, we love Magic, we love D&D, we love this. And like, and they were just playing the game before the show started, you know, with each other. And so we found that we're able to kind of unite all of those fandoms in a safe space, right? Within this environment for them to just sit down and be in this celebratory environment over things that they love, which is like gaming and D&D and theater and all these different combinations. And it's like, it's a deeply underserved audience in live entertainment, right? Like just,
oh yeah, totally. Because I mean, there's a lot of situations where you're watching something and you're like, man, I wish I could have had it do this, or, you know, and just anything that you end up watching. And it's almost like the games that give you that freedom of choice to kind of choose what direction the game goes in. And once you've made that direction, it kind of goes down that path instead.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, a few years ago when I was pitching the technology, and Bandersnatch came out, right? And we'd already been working on this idea before Bandersnatch came out on Netflix. I came up to people who were like, I had to watch Bandersnatch and go through every possible iteration, right? Like I had to know every single thing that could have happened. I'm like, that is some really valuable fandom. I'm like, if I could build a show and sell tickets to that idea, right? This thing could do very well. And that's effectively what we're doing right now, right? Is that we've just built this ever-changing experience overnight that has a base, that has a foundation that is really solid. But there's just like, because it's this blend of improv and branching narrative and gamification and all these different variables, it just creates something really weird and special every single time we do it. So I'm really excited about it. I mean, like there's nothing else like it out there. And it looks like it's hooking into like the whole nerddom culture in the right way at the right time. And truth be told, it's just because it's just being built by a bunch of nerds anyway.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I think that's what's so appealing to it is not only that because it's built by nerds, but it's basically for the nerds that just love just discovering different branches of storylines. I mean, I'm one of those nerds that if I play certain video games or if there's certain books that I've read that have the kind of choose your own adventure type style to them, and I like to kind of see all the different avenues that I can go. I mean it drives me nuts if I can't. So like even some of the games where it might take too long to get through that point, I'll watch the YouTube videos of them taking this alternate branch.
Well, I mean you know, that's, you know, therein lies the problem with like what happened with Mass Effect, right? Which is they promised that the ending of that this would be your choices determine the ending at the end of the third game, and it turned out not to be true. Like, it was inconsequential, right? And so that was one of the rules. So we have a lot of rules, right, about how we build our stuff. And, you know, rule number one is every choice must have a consequence. There can be no fake choices. There can be, like, it must have a consequence in some way.
It's like life.
Yeah. And so, like, that authenticity, right, is really important for us to build in the experiences. The audience must feel like their choices matter, right? Because then they'll feel like they had a real, and they had a real truthful experience, right? And that's kind of the same thing reflected in a video game. Like, even though most video games are linear in narrative, right? If it's designed well, you can feel like your choices do matter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fun. It's really, I think what's been really been gratifying is being able to build our own fandom with this right now, right? Like that we're starting to carve out our own little niche for ourselves. Because we got fans in New York, we have fans in Pittsburgh now, we have people who are starting to come in from all over the place to see this thing. And that's a lot of fun. That's a lot of fun, is being able to service that in a live entertainment way that, like, after years of working on Broadway and off Broadway, it's validating to get this kind of reaction from a community that I was a part of but always felt very separate from my theatrical community, right? And mm-hmm. I've reached that point where it's like, let's just bring this all together and see what happens. And it seems to be working, so.
Well, and the nice thing about it is, and the kind of awesome thing with it is that it has, like, long-term longevity, just because, like you said, no two shows are the same.
Yeah. And people like that in their experience. So it's like Sleep No More. Do you know Sleep No More in New York?
Not really.
So Sleep No More is developed by this very, very wonderful company out of the UK called Punch Drunk, who's done a lot of great stuff. And basically, it's a nonverbal telling of Macbeth. It's a lot of dance. It's a lot of movement. But it takes place in this building over like five stories, right? And when you go into the Sleep No More experience, you wear a mask, right? And I mean like a big white mask so no one sees your face. And you're just kind of dropped in randomly. And the show itself is 3 hours long, and it runs about 6 hours a night. So it goes in like 2 3-hour long chunks, right? But it's all continuous all the way through, right? And you are just entered into the story randomly on various places and at various times. And so your job as an audience member is to kind of like follow and piece this thing together and choose which actor, and the whole thing is moving around you and up the floors, and you're you're following actors, you're following storylines, you're following thread and plot lines all throughout this experience. And like, I loved it when I saw it because it was an experience where I had agency, right? But none of the choices you make change the experience, right? You could make different choices that change your point of view of the experience, but the experience is always the experience. It's the same story every time. So I was very inspired by this, of saying, gosh, what if you made a choice that then determined what that actor would do? And that's part, you know, what we did with Gimmionics, but also what Gimmionics is powering in 20-Sided Tavern is the ability for the choices of the audience of Nate to change what's happening on stage in real time, right? And that's really cool, right? That you have that kind of agency. And then wanting to come back and say, well, if I made a different choice, what would have happened, right? I mean, that's just the branching narrative aspect of it that I'm so in love with this thing, right? And then, of course, like the fun thing, because it's D&D style, the role of the die, right? You'll get into a battle sequence or a situation where you can win or lose that determines which pathway you're going to go down. And it's completely up to chance. Right. And that's, I mean, like, Dagle and Sarah designed that into it. And like, that's what's like magical about it, is you have this idea of chance built into a live theatrical show that keeps everyone on their toes. It makes it really exciting.
That's awesome. So what is the potential of the gamification process? And do you see it being used in other mediums like a streaming program or like a live podcast or things like that?
Well, I think we're seeing it a lot of places right now. I mean, I think everything that Twitch is doing is gamifying the experience for their users, right? And Twitch is certainly, you know, continue to build into their technology, into their streaming technology, this this communication between their streamers and their audience, right? And so I see a lot of the gamification of engagement happening over there, and you know, rightfully so on that platform. You know, it's not real time, like Twitch is lagged. It's you know, it's
oh
not,
yeah,
you know, but you know, it's still that it, there's still has that gamification. We've seen Netflix make a move into from Bandersnatch into children's programming, but rumor has it they're still investing pretty heavily into more branching narrative stuff that's out there. So we're certainly seeing more of that happening. I think you're seeing a lot of stuff happening on the experiential entertainment side, where the audience is getting more involved, where it's becoming more gamified in terms of their engagement. And like, you know, I'm just sort of approaching it from this standpoint of take the phone in your pocket, take the brick in your pocket and turn it into a tool and use that tool and create that two-way communication device, right? So like, if you look at Wizarding World, the Harry Potter world at Universal, right? Buy that $80 piece of plastic wand, right? And an RFID chip is buried into it, right? And that's a gamification of experience. You run around that park, you wave a wand, you unlock a thing, right? But that communication is one way, right? It's a one-way instance of me waving the RFID check and something happening and the thing going on, right? And I thought that's really cool. What if it becomes a two-way conversation? Like, what if it's a back and forth that can happen between the thing? And so we've seen it with the Galactic Starship with Star Wars, right? At Disney.
Yep.
And they went heavily into CYOC and LARPing and like, and all these concepts are coming into it. And I've heard, I don't know, you know, I've heard various degrees of success or unsuccess with that thing. I'm not going to pay $5,000 to see it.
Nope.
Quite yet at this point in my life, right? Like, that's not going to happen today. But you know, they're leaning heavy because audiences, and I think it's so true coming out of the pandemic, is like, we don't want passive entertainment anymore. We want, if we're going to go out and spend money, we want to have an experience. And that wave has been coming for a while now, and it seems to like it's really starting to take off.
And I think it's also the natural evolution of just media and entertainment in general, just because people are kind of, I mean, especially with all the streamers and everything else going on, I think that it's more of a, people want that community. They want that back and forth. They don't want to just sit and just veg in front of a screen.
We want the holodeck, right? I mean, that's what we want. Yes. My husband and I say this to each other all the time, is that like, at the end of the day, all we're doing is trying to build the holodeck, right? Like we're trying to build this environment, because it's so true. I mean, that was in Star Trek, those moments, there were so many good ways that they used the holodeck, right? To tell a lesson or tell a story or do something, right? And but also using it as an entertainment device on the ship, which I always find to be really fascinating. And it's like, yeah, of course, like, you know, they're totally predicting what people want. You know, they want to have a realistic experience. And like, you know, all this stuff about the metaverse, I'm not anti anything, but like, I'm struggling with the metaverse right now. It's like right? Well, it's like, you're going to have to, how many people are going to be able to afford a $400 headset? Like, how is this really going to, how's this going to work, really? And everyone's like, oh no, it's going to be huge. And I'm like, but will it?
Like, yeah, that's kind of my mentality on it too, because I just don't know how accessible it's going to be. Whereas like, you know, with your product and your company, you know, what you're doing with it, you're using things people already have.
Yeah.
Well, so it's very accessible in that sense. Like it's not, there's no like barrier to entry. Whereas, you know, I feel like the metaverse, it's still going to be those people that are very highly enthusiastic. And then you're going to have the people kind of on the fence, like, I don't know if I want to spend that.
Well, I mean, it's the same problem with VR. VR is amazing. Like I can't tell you how many times, like, and I certainly, I've had this experience, or you probably have as well, is like you put on a VR headset and you're like, oh my God, this is the future. And then after like the 100th time you've done it, you're like, well, I'm going to go walk in the park.
Yep.
Right. It's just like, it's like, it's really cool and it's really useful, but
until it's not.
And it's like, it's been coming for so long and there's been billions of dollars invested in it. Like, oh, it's going to be so great. And it's like, yeah, but you know, it's been like, I don't doubt that that it will slip into the collective zeitgeist of how we operate in the world within the coming decades. I'm kind of just more interested in developing something now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and also, again, I'm a live entertainment guy. Like the space that I occupy is the room where we all get together as people. So of course, like, the metaverse is interesting to me, but it's also like, well, you know, I also work in an art form that goes back 5,000 years and has always been successful. So like, I'm just enhancing that.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think it totally works. And actually when I was doing my research, I was pretty interested because I've never seen anything like it, which is kind of just a testament to itself.
There, it's that, yes, and I appreciate that, and I'll take the compliment.
Yeah, I mean, I know that they've had things where, you know, the audience can kind of vote and do things from the chair. I mean, you know, America's Funniest Videos did stuff like that for years, and all of the different competition shows. But I mean, you look at it, they're literally with a giant, yeah, you know, like 80s cell phone type thing, pressing buttons on it, and it's attached to the back of the seat. I mean, it's very trivial and cumbersome and expensive.
It's the hard part is that it's very new, right? It is a new approach into the live space, and it certainly is taking a lot of convincing of people to say, no, accept the cell phone. And so part of my mission, and this is a big part where 20 Side Tavern comes in, is because 20 Side Tavern is a separate company from Gameonics. I mean, Gameonics is a partner in that company, but it's totally a separate company. And the reason why I've gone for it is because it's like, you know, look, I liken it to Nintendo. And I'm not trying to self-aggrandize and say, oh my God, I'm Nintendo, because I'm not, right? But
yeah,
you know, if you look at the history of gaming, of course, which I studied, right? You had Atari, you know, come out, and VR. I mean, VR should take a big, big clue from this. You had Atari come out, and back in the 1980s, we had an Atari when I was growing up, and the hardware could only advance so far, right? And then cabinet gaming, arcade gaming, right? Then mm-hmm. kind of yep. came in, and they were just better games, right? Like, you could build this cabinet and you could build better gaming experiences, right? Than you could in the limited, size of the Atari. So the at-home gaming systems just kind of went out the wayside because all the kids were then flocking to the mall to play the arcade games. I was one of them, right? Back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then Nintendo comes along in the early 90s with just a better system, right? And they came out, and then they had to build their Super Mario Brothers and their Duck Hunt, right? Because that's what really, yep. those are the two games that really launched Nintendo. Those are all things I remember. And from that point on, Nintendo owned the market for 10 years, right? They made billions of dollars.
Oh yeah, easily.
And it took a decade for Sony and for Microsoft to catch up, right? To be able to start building their, but they own that thing for a decade. But I mean, I'm looking at this situation right now with Gameonics and saying, I've got really good, sophisticated software. It's like really, really good, smart software. And lots of people have tried to play around in this space. And I'm like, you know, the problem is you got to make it easy
mm-hmm.
for people to use, which Nintendo is super easy to use. But you also have to build that Super Mario Brothers. And that's where 20 Side Tavern is for me right now. It's like building that experience that the software is powered that makes everyone be like, oh my God, we need to get in on this. And so that's kind of really what I'm after in, but then also at the same time of like just staying true to my roots and saying, let's build an experience that appeals to an audience that is just simply underserved, right? And so I think that's also what Nintendo did, is like there was an at-home audience that was still waiting there, right? That just didn't have access to anything until they came along. They're like, where have you been? And then they produced content for a decade and just owned it.
Oh yeah, totally.
I still remember when I got my first PlayStation. Right? I was so excited when the PlayStation came out. And my Game Boy, right? It's Game Boy?
Oh,
Game
yeah.
Boy was a Nintendo product, right? Yeah, Game Boy was a Nintendo product.
Oh yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So what's something you'd love to see happen with this technology?
So, you know, it's a good question.
I know, curveball.
Yeah, right. I feel like One of the things that we're working on right now, and this is super important to me, actually has to do with accessibility, right? And one of the things that we've discovered that we can do is with a script, right? When scripted environments, to be able to do closed captioning, right?
Oh, cool.
And I'm about to launch a pilot program this fall with the university. They haven't signed their contract yet, so I can't say, right?
Yeah.
But they're in the process of signing it. So where we demoed this tech for them, and they sign, and they're like, we're signing up for a year to do this, right? Because this idea that accessibility is really important in the live space, but it's really like, it's really hard to do. And there's some software out there that does some speech to text and does some things, but you know, for the most part, it's really old school and being like, we're going to have an accessible performance and hire a sign language interpreter. And this is what we're going to do. And I was like, what if every performance was closed captioned, right? And what if that closed captioned was simply just going to the person's phone during the course of it, so they didn't have to buy an audio device or rent something, or you have to schedule a separate performance? Like, that every single performance that you put on at your event is, again, as long as it's scripted, was accessible, right? And I when we discovered this, it was like, gosh, this is really a big changer in honestly just making like the idea of accessibility in the live space, making it much more democratized, much more for everyone. Because like, we're releasing a new version of the software in a few months from now. And one of the things that we're able to do is have language translation, right? So I'll put a script into the software and be able to do this kind of closed captioning, but be able to do it in multiple languages. And
nice.
One of the things that I think, you know, on Broadway, I've watched a lot of the struggles in being able to access other communities, right? And language is a barrier. It's like, well, what if language is no longer a barrier in that you're able to advertise for every performance? Because like, advertising one performance is as accessible isn't good enough, right? Like, and so being able to say, hey, you know, for the hearing impaired community, you know, you can come and it will always be available for you for these shows. And oh, if you don't speak English, but you want to start getting introduced to this, well, we can send it to you in your own language and you can watch along. I mean, God's sakes, the Met's been doing it for years, right? But they built a massively expensive hardware software system that no one else in the world can really replicate because it's so expensive. And I'm like, well, what if we just do it this way and it's cheap,
mm-hmm.
right? And so that's the vision that I really have for it is being able to open up live entertainment to larger audiences, right? To speak to more people. I think is a really powerful idea, and it's something that I'm really aggressively pursuing because I think it can be really useful for venues and for content creators and for people trying to develop audiences and bringing different types of communities together in the same space, rather than you know tribalizing them out in their own ways. It's like, no, if we put them all in the same space, we might be able to get a better audience at the end of the day. And so that's the big idea that I'm after right now.
Very, very cool.
And then the museum thing, like going on an adventure in a museum, like is weirdly enough just super important to me, right? Like just this idea of transforming a space into an adventure zone for someone and it's all sitting there on your phone is like, that's the kid in me being like, oh my God, I would have gone to a museum every weekend if that was the case.
Oh yeah, you know? Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely a different experience, and I'd love to see that in action actually, so.
Hopefully this fall. I got a lot of work to do this summer, but hopefully this fall we'll be able to start figuring. I got one of my writers who's developing it right now, and so we're starting to shop it around. And yeah, it's tough, you know. We got to find that right partner who wants to be an earlier adopter, and then once they get it, we prove that it works. Off it goes. So that's basically what the next year of my life is. It's just like just banging down doors, saying, "No, you got to do this."
Awesome. So before we let you go, how can our listeners find out or find you and find the various projects you have coming up that you've talked about?
So you can reach out to me through Gameiotics, through the website. If you just Google Gameiotics, you come to our website. I'm really easy to find. It's david@gameiotics.com. Or you can just do an email through the website. I'd strongly encourage looking up the 20sidedtavern.com or the 20sided tavern and searching for that, because that's the show that we're building. And you can follow that along. Like I said, we're going to be doing a week in New York. The week of July 18th in New York, we're already on sale for that. And then we're on sale for Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And then you know, fingers crossed, the few things go right in the next few weeks, we'll have a production up this fall somewhere in the continental US, and then maybe another one after that. So it's fun. I mean, like, if you like D&D and you like gaming and you like the, you know, everything I talked about, like, that's the one, that's a big one to watch. So yeah, that's how you find me.
Awesome. Awesome. So I'd like to thank you again, David, for taking the time to chat with us here on this Altered Geek interview. So
thanks so much. Thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me just spout off about my passions for a little while. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. It was very fun. So until next time, listeners, get altered, get geeky with the Altered Geeks.